I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it's wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take it back.
Good evening and welcome to Cambridge Forum. Tonight we have two wonderfully distinguished guests, both of whom are journalists and brother and sister. They are co-authors of this book, which celebrates 20 years of Democracy Now!, which is a very well-known TV, radio, and internet news program hosted by award-winning international journalist Amy Goodman. Amy first began hosting a show on Pacifica Radio to cover the 1996 election. And back then, it was the only daily election news hour in public broadcasting. Goodman brought the voices and opinions of the unheard to the airwaves. And then over the next 20 years, she gathered many, many awards. In 2014, the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard honored Goodman with the I.F. Stone Medal for Journalistic Independence Lifetime Achievement Award. She's also the first journalist to receive the Right Livelihood Award, widely known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, for developing an innovative model of truly independent grassroots politics journalism that brings to millions of people the alternative voices that are often excluded by the mainstream media. Two decades later, we find ourselves in another election year, and Goodman is still giving voice to those outside the mainstream media with her program Democracy Now! These days, it is the largest public media collaboration in the United States, and it broadcasts to 1,400 public TV and radio stations around the world, and to millions more who view it online. Some would call her an incurable optimist, but Amy Goodman persists in her belief that small acts of defiance can create big historic change. First tonight, I'm going to introduce David Goodman, Amy's brother and co-author of the book, which is already on the New York Times bestsellers list. Welcome, David Goodman.
Well, it's great to be back at the Cambridge Forum. In 1995, in December 1995, Amy was in a safe house in Haiti covering elections there. The government opponents feared for their lives, and people were putting their lives, you know, in their hands to come out and simply exercise the right to vote. It was while she was in that safe house that she got a phone call asking if she would host a new show for Pacifica Radio to be called Democracy Now! So about a few weeks later, Amy came home to announce this new venture. So when she told my parents that she was going to be hosting an election show, well, first, of course, the family had to discuss this, and we had a variety of responses. I very helpfully suggested to her that the name Democracy Now! Would never fly. Nobody would listen to a show like that. She needed to kind of go stealth, you know, just like the election hour or something really discreet. My parents, on the other hand, were absolutely thrilled. Finally, Amy was going to have a boring desk job. She was going to be like Walter Cronkite, the voice of God, where she would just hold forth and talk about who was up, who was down, who was hot, who's not, and then call it a day, a few days after election day, fold up shop. Well, my parents' wish was rooted in the fact that Amy had already shown the kind of journalism that she was most interested in, and that was journalism from the grassroots. Journalism told from the perspective of the people who were most affected, going to where the silence is. And that's why she had, in 1991, survived a massacre in East Timor a place that really no one had ever heard of unless they had read books by Noam Chomsky, who was one of the only people writing about the genocide in East Timor, a place where they had killed a third of the population and had been completely walled off from the outside world. Until Amy and a very brave journalist colleague of hers, Alan Nairn, showed up, and in the course of their undercover coverage, there was a massacre that they survived barely. So this was 5 years later. As it turned out, as I said, the idea that this would be a boring desk job, as we all know, did not come to pass, because really, Democracy Now! Did not fold up after the 1996 election. And for those of you who are wondering, that was the re-election campaign of Bill Clinton. He was running against Bob Dole and another billionaire-turned-candidate by the name of Ross Perot. So the show got to Election Day and kept going, and Amy will talk more about it, but it was really the style of journalism that Amy and Democracy Now!, the team of Democracy Now!, were pioneering. Democracy Now! Has continued because it has not gone to the leaders in Washington, the leaders in corporate boardrooms. It has covered the real forces making change in our country, and that is the movements. People who come together all over the place, around kitchen tables, in churches, in universities, wherever they find themselves, or just in the streets. Those are the movements that we chronicle in our new book. The movements like the LGBTQ movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, the climate change movement, and the independent media movement itself, those and so many others. Democracy Now! Has been the place where many of us, and perhaps you all, go to find out that you are not crazy and you are not alone. So this is a celebration of 20 years of fearless independent journalism, and also a nod to the person who I think is the most courageous and essential journalist in America today, my sister Amy.
Thank you so much. It is a great honor to be back here at the Cambridge Forum. You know that originally I come from Pacifica Radio. We are on this 100-city tour, and just last week I was in Berkeley celebrating the first Pacifica station. So many of these stops are celebrating community media. KPFA, the first Pacifica station, began in Berkeley in 1949. It was right after World War II. A war resister, a conscientious objector named Lou Hill, came out of the detention camps and said, there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. Not run by corporations that George Gerbner would say, the late dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. Not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell that are raising our children today. And so the first Pacifica station, KPFA, went on the air in 1949. The second, KPFK in Los Angeles in 59. The third, my station in New York, WBAI, within its first years on air, it was broadcasting a debate between the great writer James Baldwin and Malcolm X on the effectiveness of nonviolent civil disobedience, on the effectiveness of the lunch counter sit-ins of the South. I want to go back to KPFT that went on the air in the spring of 1970 in the Petro Metro in Houston. It's the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up in the first weeks of operation, blown to smithereens. The Ku Klux Klan strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it up. Now, it was right in the middle of Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant. And I thought that was a good song. But so it took a few weeks. I mean, I guess you could say the silver lining. It's not like Pacific had money for advertising. It certainly blew it into the consciousness of the potential listening audience of the people of Houston. I don't recommend that as an advertising strategy. But and they got back on their feet, and they went back on the air. PBS came in to broadcast this historic moment. KPFT went back on the air, and Arlo Guthrie came in to finish singing Alice's Restaurant. Now, I can't remember if it was the Grand Dragon or the Exalted Cyclops, because I often confuse their titles. But he said it was his proudest act. And I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it's a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, whether it's an uncle in Afghanistan, an aunt in Iraq, maybe it's a kid from the South Valley in Albuquerque, where we were just speaking at RFK High School. The overwhelming majority of the population of that high school is undocumented immigrant students. Whether it's a kid from the South Bronx. You're hearing someone speak from their own experience. It challenges the bigotry, the stereotypes, the caricatures that fuel these hate groups. You know, you might say, it sounds like my bubba, my baby, my aunt, my uncle. And I'm not saying you'll agree with them. How often do you agree with your family members? But you begin to understand where they're coming from. That understanding is the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it's wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take it back. Now, I just told you a story about history, like from, 46 years ago, when KPFT was blown up by the Ku Klux Klan. I can't believe we are talking about the Ku Klux Klan today in the 2016 presidential election. How is it possible that the presumptive nominee of a major political party in this country, Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, when asked on CNN by Jake Tapper if he would disavow the support of an avowed Klan leader, right, David Duke, whether he would disavow his support and the support of the Klan, Donald Trump said, he would have to look more deeply into this, consider this. When was the last time you heard Donald Trump say he needed to consider anything before he spoke? And what was it that he had to weigh more carefully? Which Klan chapter it was, because he wouldn't want to generalize to all the Klan chapters in the United States? It's extremely serious. And that's also why we need independent media. I know young people here, you've heard of the Ku Klux Klan, but do you understand exactly what it did? You know, Democracy Now!, we come from New York. We were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero, September 11th, 2001. That horrific moment when 3,000 people were incinerated in an instant. We'll actually never know how many people died on that day, because those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death. And they were the undocumented workers and immigrants who might have been there at that time. But what a horror that day was. However, it was not the first time that terror came to U.S. soil. Ask any African American about slavery. Ask any Native American about what's happened in this country. The Ku Klux Klan is a homegrown American terroristic organization. It was responsible for the deaths of how many thousands of people, particularly targeting African Americans, lynchings, killings, maimings. We cannot minimize the horror. I wanted to go back to last year. I wanted to go back to last June, to a moment in history that you all are familiar with, the middle of June 2015 in Charleston, South Carolina. That was the moment that a young man, a young white supremacist, walked into a Bible study group of nine, actually a few more than that, of parishioners and their beloved pastor, Clemente Pinckney. He was a state senator in South Carolina. He'd raced home 2 hours just because he wanted to be at this Bible study with his parishioners midweek in the evening. And this young white man came in, and they welcomed him as they welcomed each other. And at the end of Bible study, he blew them away. He didn't kill everyone. He told a woman he wanted her to survive so she would bear witness and tell the rest of the world what he had done. A few days later, Dylan Stormroof was arraigned, and the loved ones of the victims and the survivors put this country to shame when they forgave him. I think Dylan Roof unwittingly blew the roof off of the Confederacy. Now, a few days later, Clemente Pinckney would be one of the few African Americans to lay in state in the South Carolina Capitol Rotunda. Thousands streamed by to pay their respects, but first they had to pass on the outside, on the Capitol grounds. They had to pass by the Confederate flag flying high on those grounds that young man had wrapped himself in. You see, the Confederate flag has flown over the capital of South Carolina since the early 60s, atop the capital. But then in 2000, the NAACP and even some sports franchises said they would boycott South Carolina if they didn't take it down. And the compromise was it would stand on the grounds of the capital, but you could never unhook it. It could never fly at half mast. And anyone who tried to deface it or take it down would face increased penalties. We raced to South Carolina. We broadcast in front of the Mother Emanuel Church. We went to the College of Charleston arena. Thousands packed into the arena. That's when President Obama sang Amazing Grace. And then the next day, the beginning of the funerals, one by one. But we heard that next morning that something highly unusual had taken place in Columbia at the state capitol. Now, I think if most people were asked in this country who took down the Confederate flag off of the grounds after more than half a century, I think most people would say probably South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, that she sort of led the charge of the legislature. But it wasn't Nikki Haley who first took down that flag. It was 5:30 in the morning on June 27, 2015, 10 days after the massacre at the Emanuel AME Church. The South Carolina State House glowed in the morning light. Bree Newsom, a 30-year-old African-American woman from Charlotte, North Carolina, walked toward the main entrance of the building. She was accompanied by Jimmy Tyson, a young white man from North Carolina, and others who scouted the grounds. They observed the scene around the state house, waiting until there were no guards visible. After about 30 minutes, Tyson and Newsom made their move. They walked swiftly toward the Confederate monument, which stands directly in front of the main steps. The tall monument, topped with a heroic image of a Confederate soldier, pays tribute to those who have glorified a fallen cause, slavery. The two activists proceeded to the 30-foot-high flagpole that stood directly behind the monument. The Confederate battle flag flapped lazily at the top. You know that all the flags of South Carolina flew at half-mast after the beautiful nine were massacred, except this one that waved proudly at full mast. Bree Newsom then donned her climbing gear. Guards moved quickly, noticing that she was ascending the flagpole swiftly, and they began shouting at her to come down. Reaching the top of the flagpole, she grabbed the Confederate flag and unhooked it. She declared, "You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God." She clutched the symbol of the Confederacy and said, "This flag comes down today." Bree lowered herself slowly along with the flag. As soon as she reached the ground, Newsom and Tyson were arrested. Video of the protest went viral, was seen around the world. Her bail fund quickly raised more than $125,000. But within about an hour, two state house workers raised a new Confederate flag on the Capitol grounds. I mean, that is astounding. To actually deliberately raise that flag the day after the mass funeral, to raise that flag that same day that the bodies of the victims were being lowered into the ground in Charleston. But that's what they did. So we raced from Charleston to Columbia and went to the jailhouse where we thought Bree and Jimmy were taken. And we actually managed to get into the arraignment room and watch them charged and arraigned. Yes, Bree and Jimmy were charged with defacing state property, facing a penalty of up to 3 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. We then went to the lobby of the prison where people were gathering, hoping that Bree and Jimmy would be released that day. And I was interviewing people. I interviewed Tamika Lewis. She was a young woman who had come with Bree from North Carolina, traveling to Columbia to be part of this action. She said, "To see that flag actually come down and all the things that it represents being taken down by a strong black woman was one of the greatest symbolic images one person could ever witness." Another young woman named Carol Parker, she didn't know Bree. She grew up in Columbia, South Carolina. She walked past that flag every day, humiliated, denigrated. And she said she just was so inspired, she came to show Bree her support. Carol Parker said, "She's done what our governor hasn't had the courage to do, what our General Assembly hasn't had the courage to do. She went up there and did what had to be done when it needed to be done." Yes, it was Bree Newsom who took down the symbol of the Confederacy in South Carolina. Now, I can't talk about Democracy Now! Without talking about my co-host of 20 years, Juan Gonzalez. And Juan has been a columnist with the New York Daily News for the last 29 years. He just retired. But a few months before, Juan was inducted into the New York Journalism Hall of Fame. And all of us at Democracy Now! Went to bear witness. We went to Sardi's in Midtown Manhattan. And when Juan got up, he was the first Latino journalist to be inducted. He talked about his quarter century as a columnist. He said, "I figured my modest contribution would be not writing about outcast neighborhoods, but from them. Not simply to entertain, but to change. Not after the fact, but before it, when coverage could still make a difference." He said, "I've tried to use as many of my columns as possible to probe the injustices visited upon the powerless. Yes, the rich and famous are also victims on occasion, but they have so many politicians, lobbyists, lawyers, gossip columnists, and even editorial writers ready to jump to their defense that they'll always do fine without my help." He said, "I prefer the desperate unknown reader who comes to me because he or she has gone everywhere else and no one will listen. More often than not, I come across unexpected gems, human beings whose tragedies illuminate the landscape and whose courage hopefully inspires the reader to believe that there is indeed some greater good served by a free press than just chronicling or influencing the ouster of one group of politicians by another." Those are the words of Juan Gonzalez. And we end our introduction by simply saying this book celebrates some of the people and movements who've been making history during our first 20 years. It's not an exhaustive history, nor is it intended as a greatest hits of Democracy Now! This book is just our way of giving back by celebrating some of the ordinary heroes who've done extraordinary things to make the world a better place. Now, We were really excited to hear in our first week, the book was published on April 12th, that it had hit the New York Times bestseller list. This was truly exciting because, you know, it's not like the New York Times likes to talk about Democracy Now! We have a joke at Democracy Now! That Webster's will one day redefine exclusive as last heard on Democracy Now! Maybe a month before or a year before. There was this funny moment on MSNBC that in their billboard, you know, at the beginning of a show, they showed the clip of a whistleblower speaking, and they said, and it said in the lower third, exclusive. They were about to talk to him. But the exclusive actually covered up our logo, because we had spoken to him a month before and they were showing our clip and then they were going to be talking to him. But that's okay. It's okay because our philosophy is steal this story, please. We call it trickle-up journalism. But so, and it was particularly exhilarating to hit the Times bestseller list because, well, the book is called Democracy Now!, so the actual words Democracy Now! Would be in the pages of the New York Times, not because they could control it, it's just a mathematical equation, but more seriously, it really does make a huge difference. And just before we left on this tour, we got an email from a prison administrator in England. A year ago, he asked if he could download Democracy Now!, the TV broadcast, and run it on the prison closed-circuit television, which, of course, we agreed to right away. Now, he said, after a year, there is a 50% increase in the prisoners enrolling in classes, hungry for more information. Information is power. So what's wonderful about being on the Times bestseller list, you may not realize this, and certainly going to visit the Harvard bookstore again today, it's not true there. But in so many bookstores, they just buy the bestseller list. Prison libraries, also, believe it or not, libraries these days, as their resources are cut back. And we want to be in all of these places because really fine people go into all of them and they're looking to expand their minds and imaginations, travel the world, continents and centuries without even physically going anywhere, but opening up their minds. And we want to be there to provide a roadmap to other universes, other galaxies of thought and media, because I think that's really where the hope is. Anytime you have ideas for stories, please email stories@democracynow.org. Send us articles, or if it's before articles have been written, send us what's happening. Send us contact information for people you want interviewed. This is how Democracy Now! Has grown from 9 community stations in 1996 to the largest public media collaboration in this country, over 1,400 public radio and television stations in this country and around the world. And this is how we build independent media. It's done on the ground, very transparently, encouraging you to be a part of the movement for independent media in this country and around the world. We will not be silent. Democracy Now!
You have been listening to Changing America, 20 Years of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, a Cambridge Forum event recorded live in May 2016 at First Parish in Harvard Square. We are co-sponsored by the Massachusetts Cultural Council and the Friends of Cambridge Forum. Thank you so much for listening.